From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Alana Nash is my guest this week, the highly respected journalist who has contributed to the New York Times, Entertainment Weekly, and other publications, has written about Dolly Parton, Jessica Savage, and Elvis Presley. Her latest book is Baby, Let's Play House, Elvis Presley and the Women Who Loved Him. Alana Nash, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Gary, thank you so much.
Well, you know, I guess the first question that I want to ask is that I think this is the 46,000th book on the King. So obviously you must have felt that there was a real need for this further volume. I mean, I know you've already written a couple. And I know that our friends from the bookshelf friends, David Haydu and Philip Norman, both love your book as they praise it on the back. But what do you know that Peter Guralnick and Jerry Hopkins didn't, or that you didn't cover in your previous books?
Well, you know, nobody had really looked at him primarily from the female point of view, taking a closer look just at, say, the women who helped shape him and the women who were around him reporting what they saw and what they learned about him. And I never really thought to do this, and I have to admit that this was not even my idea, in that it kind of grew out of an assignment for Ladies Home Journal, where I wrote really just an oral history of six or eight women who knew him for half of a cover, not even a full cover, of the magazine's August 2007 issue to commemorate the 30th anniversary of his passing. And my editor there, Nancy Beaulieu, not to be confused with Priscilla Beaulieu, you know, she called and she said, well, we want some kind of story, and I'm not really sure what. And I said, well, you know, it's a woman's magazine. It's Elvis. It just seemed natural just to find women to talk about Elvis. And I did that story, and it got an awful lot of attention. It spawned a segment on the CBS Early Show, and it drew a lot more entries for a contest that they ran with it than they were expecting. And Nancy said, well, there's your next book. And, you know, I kind of laughed. I didn't take it seriously. And I thought, oh, gosh, you know, I've done three. I can't imagine doing another one. And then I just went, you know, that's perfect. That's perfect. So I have to give her credit, really.
And so 600 pages later, you have a you apparently found a lot to say about it.
Well, you know, what I usually don't tell people is that I thought I was going to be doing kind of a short, quick book. I thought I would. There was a fellow named Bill Burke, Bill E. Burke, who was the a columnist for the Memphis Press-Sumeter, what used to be the afternoon paper there. And when Elvis died, I was sent there to by the Courier-Journal, the Louisville paper, to cover the funeral. And I met Bill then, and I didn't know anybody in Memphis, and he kind of took me under his wing and introduced me to a lot of people. And that's how my writing about Elvis started, although I had been a huge fan as a child. But Bill did a series of books, really important reporting, where he did a series where he went to Tupelo and talked to people who knew Elvis then for the early years. He did a high school book. He did a number of books, and where he just talked to people who knew him. And he devoted a chapter to each person. And I thought I would do that about the women with some kind of introductory explanatory note. And then I interviewed Peter Whitmer, who's a sociologist, or rather a psychologist, I guess a bit of a sociologist too, but Dr. Whitmer is the author of The Inner Elvis, which came out a few years back, and I already knew him. I helped him get a photograph for that book, and then he returned the favor about a thousandfold as a consultant for a book I wrote about Colonel Tom Parker called The Colonel, The Extraordinary Story of Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis Presley. So I got off the phone with Peter. I said, you know, tell me what his psychological mindset was in regard to women. And by the time we finished a couple of hours later, I got really scared. I hung up that phone and I shook because I realized I couldn't just write a chapter on each woman, a significant woman. I had to write a whole biography and lace these women throughout the story, because without the background and placing them in context, historical, chronological context, their stories would not resonate as well with the reader, and I didn't think we'd get the poignancy of those failed relationships as well. So here I was, and I'm kind of embarrassed to tell you this, but here I was like about 6 weeks out from my deadline, thinking I was doing this short, quick book, realizing I had to write this whole story and lace all these women through, and I had to do a lot more reporting than I was thinking I was going to have to do. So it was terrifying. It was just terrifying. My editor called and said, I hope your manuscript is coming in on time because we have big plans for this. And I said, hey, no, not a problem. And I hadn't written the first word.
Well, you know, we have a lot of pictures of Elvis from, I don't mean photographs, but I mean from the various biographies that have been written about him. And I guess every version is a life of Elvis, and none of them are the life. But one of the books that came to mind when I was reading yours is Priscilla's book. And you kind of get the feeling that Elvis didn't really enjoy the company of women much, that he much preferred the company of men.
Well, Elvis was very, very different with the women in his life than he was the men in his life. And he's almost two different people. And actually, he preferred to be with women. I think he was just, in some ways, scared to be with women his own age. He loved to be with younger women and even teenagers. He loved to be with younger people in general.
Well, it's not a classic quote of Elvis's. Elvis, how come you never date women your own age? And he said, what would I want with a 40-year-old woman?
Exactly. Exactly right, which is very sad. Very sad.
Really.
But, he got stuck. Dr. Whitmer, Peter Whitmer, helped me see that he got stuck from about somewhere between 15 and 17 years old emotionally, that he never really grew much beyond that. So to date, teenagers, as Priscilla was certainly when he first met her, I mean, she was 14 when they met, 16 when she moved to Memphis, seemed right for him because he was 17.
Well, do you think it was that he was emotionally 17 or that he didn't want to be challenged by anybody?
That's the other part of it. That's a really good question, and that is the other part of it. He didn't want to be challenged. He wanted to be a hero. A grown woman really scared him emotionally. He didn't because he was a man child. He never really grew up at all. So to be an equal partner in what a so-called normal relationship was really, really scary. He really just wanted to be idolized. He wanted to be mothered. He craved the company and the attention and the approval of women, but only women really of a certain mindset.
Well, there was a certain. I suppose it still occurs, but there was a time in America in which it was totally accepted to be a mama's boy and someone who really loved their mother. In the category of performers like Elvis, there was Houdini and Al Jolson, who were both sort of famous mother lovers. And I guess Gladys was the main woman in Elvis's life for a long time.
I think she was the main woman in his life always. I don't think he ever got over... First of all, he couldn't separate from her psychologically. What was interesting to me, and I didn't realize this until I was writing the cut lines for the pictures in the book, is that 9 times out of 10, if you see pictures of them together, anywhere together, I mean, sitting at home or even out in public, in front of their house or anywhere, really, they're touching. He's holding her hand most of the time, or he has his arm around her, or... he's kissing her. Even when Al Wertheimer went to the Ottoman Drive house, a wonderful iconic picture of Elvis kissing his mother on the cheek. He had no shame about that. You're right. You know, Al Jolson, Houdini, and of the time, of course they came earlier, 20s, 30s, but it carried through to Elvis's mindset. He's always even when he was with a girlfriend in Gladys's presence. If he's holding the girl's hand, he's holding his mother's hand, too.
Yeah, there's a picture in your book of Elvis with Jackie Rowland, and he's got his arm around her, and he has his other arm on his mother.
Right, sitting at home on Ottoman Drive on the sofa.
Yeah.
I think it's so his mother wouldn't feel slighted, but, she wanted him to marry and have children, and she was intuitive. You know, I don't think she was literate. There's a wonderful letter that I reproduce in the photo insert as a reproduction or an illustration of a letter she wrote trying to get Vernon released from prison. Vernon went to prison when Elvis was 3 for altering a check. And she masterminded a campaign to get him either paroled or released early. A wonderful letter. I don't think it's her handwriting. I'm pretty certain it's not her handwriting. But you know, she wasn't the most literate person, but she was very intuitive, and she knew she wasn't going to be around long, and she wanted to see her son settled and happy, and she wanted grandchildren, and she was trying to get him to hurry up, but he couldn't separate from her. And you know, just to wrap up your question, he never stopped wanting to be reunited with her after her death in 1958 when he was 23, and he tried to turn every serious girlfriend into a mother. And near the end of his life, he held a séance to try to reach her. So he never got beyond being Gladys's boy.
We're speaking, if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Alana Nash, and her book is called Baby, Let's Play House, Elvis Presley and the Women Who Loved Him. Now, also, I think it's in Priscilla's book, that once Priscilla became a mother, he was no longer interested in her.
It is in Priscilla's book, yeah. But she has sort of changed her mind about that, or certainly has told reporters something a little bit different in recent years, that certainly they had some form of sexual relations. It may have just been, you know, he really preferred foreplay to actual intercourse. He liked everything that led up to intercourse more than the act itself. So my guess is what she's saying now is that they resumed that, but perhaps not full intercourse. And you know, Joe Esposito and others had said that, you know, once if he helped Elvis find girls, he would say to girls he knew who had a child, "Don't tell Elvis you have a child, or he won't want to be with you." But one of the surprises of my research is that I kept running into, or well, I should, that's not precisely correct. I found three women just in the course of my research, talking to them about their romance with Elvis or their relationship with him, and they mentioned that they did have a child. And the first time it happened with a wonderful woman named Susan Henning, who was in one of his films playing a mermaid, and then is kind of a significant but unnamed person in the 68 comeback special. I got off the phone with her before it dawned on me that she told me that she had a child. And I had to call her back, and I had to say, you know, I have to ask you about this specifically. You haven't really ever said whether this was a physical relationship. You've kind of hinted around about it. But I need to really ask you about that, because the story is that he never would have relations with a woman who had a child. And she said, she came clean about it. You know, we're just talking about this psychologically, and it takes kind of the embarrassment out of it. But she said, absolutely, he knew that she had a daughter. And Barbara Lee is another woman he dated who had a son. He knew about the son. And then I found Ann Pennington, whose name may not resonate loudly with listeners, but her sister Janice was a regular for years and years on The Price is Right. She's almost a household name.
Uh-huh.
And Ann Pennington told me she had a daughter named Jessica, and she called her Jessie. Now, Jessie is the name of Elvis's lost twin, and I was not surprised once I learned that he was quite involved with that little girl. He helped bathe her. He brought her presents and candy. And so it's not quite correct to say that he wouldn't have any relations with anyone who had a child. What I finally pieced together with Peter Whitmer's help is that Elvis didn't want to have sex with a woman who'd had his child because it was too much like the closeness he had with his mother. I think it freaked him a little bit. It spooked him. But you know, it wasn't the sad part about that is that obviously it was part of the thing that doomed his own marriage, and it doomed in part his relationship in the 70s with Linda Thompson, who in some ways was an ideal mate for him. But as she said, knowing about his hang-up, as she called it, didn't make me eager to have his child, because she thought he would bolt, and he probably would have.
Well, he bolted from everybody by the end of the 70s.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, let me just ask you about that for a second, because every bio of Alana Nash tells us that you saw his body.
Yeah. Yeah, I was the freelance pop reviewer for the Courier Journal in 1977, and Elvis died on my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And the paper called and wanted me to go out to the south end of Louisville, where I live in Louisville, and interview his step-grandmother. His grandfather had run off and left Minnie May and moved to Louisville and married a school teacher here. I couldn't find her, or she didn't want to talk, but the next day the paper put me and a columnist on the company plane to cover the funeral. And a columnist was named John Filiatro, a really, really wonderful writer. And we're standing by the edge of this, what turned out to be a small press pool, because I think a lot of the national media didn't realize what a big story this was and how important Elvis was to a large segment of the public, all around the world, actually. And Dick Grobe, who was head of security there, came out with a bullhorn and just stopped in front of John and me and said, essentially, you know, members of the press who wish to view the body or Elvis, whatever he said, I don't really remember, but I do remember he said, line up behind these two, and that was John and me, and I was kind of like, wow, and the other part of me was like, oh gosh, you know, I don't, so little, it was a very surreal experience, and it was a very moving experience, first of all, to even be there, and then to file past and see him was, it just was a lot of emotions wrapped up in one.
I can imagine. Did you ever see Elvis perform? Did you ever see him live?
I did. I saw him in 1976, the only time. My sister got to go see him in 1956 when he came to Louisville, kind of a famous show because the FBI, or rather the local police, filmed his concert because he was...
It was obscene.
Obscene, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, maybe even breaking laws, and filmed it in case the FBI needed it. You know, there were all kinds of reports that he was really a national threat to the morals of youth.
What's interesting, I think, about late Elvis, you know, I guess the legend now is that, oh, you know, he had lost his skills and he was a big, fat, sweaty guy. And he was large at the end, but if you listen to him, he sounds great in 1977. How did he sound in 1976?
In 1976, when he was here at least, he was being doubled on his high notes. I think he had a little trouble. You know, he had a lot of... intestinal problems, he had liver problems. There he was kind of cinched into this jumpsuit. I think it was harder for him to expand his chest to hit some of those higher notes. you know, just this physically, he couldn't quite do it in that suit. In fact, he used to joke about it. He saying that this suit's too tight. So, you know, he had a great sense of humor. But that last concert, or rather that concert that was filmed on tour in the summer of in June of 1977, that was aired after his death, is pretty hard to watch. This is a CBS special. It's hard to watch in parts, but it's usually, you know, sort of damned as being a very sad and pathetic performance that should never have been aired. But if you watch that actually quite closely, there are moments in that where he's as great as he ever was.
The album that accompanied the special, I mean, the special hasn't been on since, I saw it then, but it hasn't been shown since. But the album that came along with it had some great performances. In fact,
yeah.
he does a version of his Sun Session, "Trying to Get to You," which sounds as great as it sounded in 1954.
The song that really stands out to me is "Hurt" and "How Great Thou Art." Also, uh-huh. Are just killer. They're just killer.
Yeah.
But there are moments in that special that really are hard to watch.
I'm sure many people. Of our generation had that sort of thought when Michael Jackson died this summer, that it was that same sort of absolutely sudden, shocking, and yet not surprising news kind of thing.
Well, you're exactly right. It's you've watched somebody decline for a while, but you don't expect it when it happens. I mean, it just kind of comes out of the blue at that moment, but you're right, not surprising given the events that led up to it. But I think what was surprising to the media was the outpouring of grief. Certainly to me, standing up near the house in that press pool, looking back over the lawn and seeing people everywhere on that lawn, a lot of them fainting from the August heat, fainting from grief, and then seeing people lined up and down Elvis Presley Boulevard on either side of the gates as far as you could see, waiting to get in to pay their respects. That was a very, very moving thing. And a lot of them, I think, literally dropped whatever they were doing all over the world, and came to Memphis because they felt as if a member of their family had died. You know, just a tremendous amount of love for a man that most of them never met.
You know, there were three great musical deaths in that autumn of 1977, and Groucho Marx on top of that. Groucho died the Saturday after Elvis died, and then within a couple of weeks, Murray Acalas and Bing Crosby both passed away. And Crosby had enjoyed an incredible career and was probably the most famous person of the 1940s and the biggest selling single record of all time, White Christmas and so on. And yet today, you know, Elvis is so well remembered, and you know, your book is not even the only book this week about that came out about Elvis. Why do you suppose Elvis has persisted?
I think it's a combination of things. First of all, the music is just so solid. There are clunkers in it, of course, particularly in the movie years when his singles were being drawn from the soundtracks of the films.
No Room to Rumba in a Sports Car.
Exactly, that's a perfect example. Where he was, the songs were written for specific scenes where he sings to a dog or he sings to a child, and or worse, you know. And he was very embarrassed by those. So, but other than situations like that, I mean, just great music that when you hear it, you were struck by what a deep and true artist he was. And then the estate has done a really remarkable job of keeping him before the public. I mean, you might question the taste of some of the products that they license. I mean, there's a new Elvis John Deere tractor, for example, because he, you know, at one point he got all excited about making it a farm. Boy, you know, I don't know. And there was that awful thing a couple of years ago, this kind of talking, singing Elvis in a it was just the shoulders up. You know, I had this head that moved and it's in the fake black leather suit. That's the worst, I think. But on the other hand, they have done a wonderful job about making sure the movies are available, the music is available, and still it's thrilling to go to Graceland. You know, I don't care how many tacky souvenirs you find across the street, just to go through that house is for some people a spiritual experience. Even if you're just going out of curiosity, you never forget it.
We're talking to Alana Nash, and her new book is called Baby, Let's Play House, Elvis Presley and the Women Who Loved Him. You know, Elvis, we know now, was a heavy drug user, not of, I guess, of the kind of drugs that predominated in the era, like LSD and so forth, but he took a lot of prescribed drugs that his doctor, who's now written a book, prescribed for him. And I think they affected him as a singer, as an actor. Now, what about as a lover? I mean, how much of a lover was he if he was all doped up?
Well, there were times when he really couldn't perform as a lover, and women talked about that. And there were times when he was just as tender and remarkable to be around in that way as ever before. He was apparently, one woman described it, Sheila Ryan, who was one of the last, I guess the last really important girlfriend, talks about he was as generous as a lover as he was the guy who gave away cars. He put everybody else's pleasure before his own, which is not something you expect from a big rock and roll star, really.
What about Ginger? She wasn't his last important love?
You know, you were the second person to ask me that question, and somebody asked me that when I was writing it. And I have to say, no, I only in that she was with him when he died.
Right.
I think that had he not died, he would not have married her, even though she claims they were engaged and she did have a ring. But I think that he proposed when he was under the influence, probably of sleeping pills. I don't think he would have followed through on that, and neither do most of the people I talked with. You know, it was an odd match, Ginger and Elvis. She was only 20. She had just turned 20 when he met her in November of 76. And November, December of 76. And I'm not sure she really wanted to be there. I think she cared about him. I don't think she was really deeply in love with him. Only she knows. Her mother certainly wanted her to be there. Her mother was a huge Elvis fan and had taken Ginger from the time she was a small child to the gates to catch a glimpse of him. But I kind of feel sorry for Ginger in many ways. Fans hold it against her that she didn't, you know, quote-unquote, save him that day, but I don't think anybody could have saved Elvis Presley, not in the long run. I think he was tired. I think he was ready to go. I think he was looking forward to being reunited with his twin and his mother.
What women did Elvis, you know, other than his mother, and I imagine Priscilla and Lisa Marie, but what women did he really love? Did he love Natalie Wood? Did he love Shelley Fabre? Who did he love?
He didn't love Natalie Wood. He was he was kind of amused by her, but he was also worried about her. I think initially they were certainly introduced by Nick Adams, his buddy, the actor Nick Adams, but the colonel liked Elvis to hang out with her because it was good publicity in 1956. She was a big star, had been a child star, and she was a wild child, that's for sure, but and Elvis was a pretty wild guy in a lot of ways, but she was wilder, really, at that stage of her life and his life. I think she beat him to that. But I think he felt sorry for her a little bit, that she hadn't really had a normal childhood, and she was crazy about him. But he saw her, you know, he liked younger girls, but I think he saw her as somebody who needed a little more parenting and needed a big brother more than she needed another boyfriend. The second person you mentioned,
Shelley Fabre.
Shelley is somebody he really cared a lot about, and that was a deep friendship with a romantic undertow. But she already was involved with somebody else, and I think she cared a lot about him. I think maybe he cared more romantically for her than she returned, because I think she's the kind of girl who wouldn't have cheated. Elvis, on the other hand, believed that he was living for two. His parents had told him that because he had survived when Jesse Garin, his twin, had not, that he had the talent for two, he had the good looks for two, he was living for two. And Elvis took it literally in many ways. I mean, starting with his second girlfriend when he was about 10 years old. From that point on, he always had more than one woman and didn't really have a problem with it, thought he was entitled.
Do you think he would have married again had he lived?
That's a really good question. I think eventually, yes. I think not right away, but eventually, yes, as he slowed down more and more. I think he would have come off the road if possible, if he had fired Colonel Parker, as he told Larry Geller in March of 77 that he was going to do, if he got with another manager who didn't run him like a racehorse, as Barbara Eden told me. She said Elvis was like a racehorse that you run too hard and then you lose. A wonderful quote. I think that And she wasn't a romance, by the way. She was a co-star and Flaming Star, and then got to know him again when he made Harum Scarum in the 60s with her then-husband, Michael Ancera. But she followed him into the showrooms of Nevada and kept up with him. But I think he would have eventually... I hope he would have gone back to Linda Thompson, really. She was a perfect combination of girlfriend and nurse, and he needed a lot of nurturing. He needed a lot of mothering, and she didn't mind playing those games that he liked to do. He liked to talk baby talk, and he liked to be the baby. He liked to put on a fireman's cap and a bib, and as he did with Sheila Ryan, and say, "I'm Elvis Presley. I'm a baby. You know, sit next to me." He really was regressing in those years, and I think he would have married again, and I think it might have saved him in some ways.
We're talking to Alanna Nash, and she has written many fine books on country music and popular culture, and her latest book is called Baby, Let's Play House, Elvis Presley and the Women Who Loved Him, and it's a marvelous book, and we haven't really even talked that much about it, so maybe you'll come back and give us another shot when it comes out in paperback.
That would be great fun. Thank you so much, Gary.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll join us again next week for another great show. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work, and special thanks to Alanna Nash, author of Baby Let's Play House, Elvis Presley, and the Women Who Loved Him, for being my guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.